then became interested in Theravada Buddhism. I'm not a Theravada Buddhist. Let's make this absolutely clear. Theravada Buddhism is another form of Buddhist orthodoxy that's as no older than the Mahayana schools. It's really a system of understanding the Buddha's teaching based on the work of a man called Buddhaghosa, who was an Indian who lived in Sri Lanka in the 5th century AD, or should I say CE. And in other words, 1,000 years after the Buddha. Come in. What I'm interested in doing is actually going back before Theravada Buddhism. It's true that Theravada Buddhism is the school that considers the Pali Canon as its primary canonical base. So in that sense, yes, my interests went to the sort of text the Theravadins study, but I don't follow the interpretations of Buddhaghosa. I'm interested, and there's a number of us now who are interested, in trying to actually get back as close as we can to what the Buddha was saying and doing. In my recent book, Confession, without an S, of a Buddhist Atheist, Confessions, I'm afraid, sounds a little bit too much a great big telling of all the terrible things I've done. And it is, in fact, a genre in itself now. If you look it up on Amazon, if you put confession in, you'll come up with confessions of a shopaholic, confessions of a teenage prostitute, confessions of this, that, and the other. Confession, I'm actually hearkening back to a text of Luther, more in the Protestant tradition, of a confession of faith. In other words, a declaration of what I most truly value and believe. And that's what this book is meant to be about. There is some confessional stuff. I do talk about my own failings and so on. But that's not the main point of the book. A large part of the book actually has to do with my attempt to... there's a space here. You're not the last, there's at least one more person coming. Wait for that. Is that a garbage truck? Is that going to be with us all morning?
Yeah.
No, it's a garbage.
Amazing sound. Okay, he's gone off to pick up somebody else's garbage. Where was I?
Confession.
Yeah, the latter parts of this book actually have to do with my quest for the historical Buddha and what is distinctive and original in his teaching. And this is very much at the heart of what I've been working on for the last few years, is A, to try to get a clearer sense of who this man was. Some of you might have come to my talk on Wednesday night where I sketched this. I don't think you can really understand what the Buddha's saying unless you understand the world in which he lived. I mean, very often we're presented with, we hear a statement like, the Buddha said, as though the Buddha had just spoken into a microphone and it had gotten written down. But of course, like any person, in any situation, you're always speaking to somebody else. Like I'm speaking to you. I don't quite know who you are, but I realize we're in Israel, so this is a Jewish cult, our culture. I don't know why you're interested in Buddhism or my particular take on it, so I've got to figure that out. And in the course of our time together, hopefully, there'll be a better rapport, a better sense of what you're interested in, and how I might be able to meet those interests. And the Buddha was, of course, in a very similar situation as any religious, philosophical teacher has to be. The trouble is, the Buddhist text, the Buddhist canon, does not tell us in detail who his audience was. We have to figure that out from other sources. We can get some sense because within the canon itself, because very often the Buddha speaks dialogically. In other words, someone will appear and say, Master Gautama, what do you mean by X? Or Master Gautama, what is this? Or what is that? And he'll give an answer. So you can see from the context of the discourse very often that the Buddha's addressing a particular interest, a particular question that was relevant at that time. So some of the discourses don't mean much to us today because very possibly the interests have moved on. We don't have the same sort of questions. But I think what has given Buddhism the capacity to survive for 2,500 years and to continue to speak to people today is because the Buddha did address questions that are not specific to Indian culture of 5th century BC. What is striking for many of us, if we've looked at some of these texts, is that they seem to be just as relevant to us now as they were then. And that, I think, points to something universal in Buddhist teaching, why it has been not only a religion that flourished in India, but also in China, in Tibet, in Japan, in Korea, in Southeast Asia, and nowadays, at least in the last 50 or so years, has now become increasingly studied and practiced in Western cultures. For people with Jewish and Christian and backgrounds primarily. I don't know whether there are any Buddhist groups in Muslim countries yet, but that might happen too. We don't know. So in order to understand what the Buddha was saying, I do think it's important to understand the kind of worldview that was current at his time. And to try to put this as simply as possible, but I'll probably come back to this point again, is that my working hypothesis, or let's say my, this is a rather technical word, my hermeneutical strategy, in other words, the way, the principles according to which I try to interpret, which is what hermeneutics means, I try to interpret what these texts mean, comes down to the question, what is it that's being said in these texts that we cannot derive from the Indian culture of the Buddha's time? If something in the Pali Canon is a statement or a belief that would have been shared by everyone in India at that time, and obviously the best example is this, is the idea of reincarnation, for example, the idea of rebirth, which is a big issue in Buddhism. Most Buddhists believe in rebirth, but it wasn't originally a Buddhist idea. It was an idea that was already around. You find it in the Upanishads being, or the earliest Upanishads being the philosophical writings that grew out of the Vedas. The Vedas were the early Indian hymns, going back about 1,000 years before the Buddha, and the Upanishads are the first attempt to somehow give a more philosophical reading to what the Vedas are actually saying. And that was the world in which the Buddha was born. He was born in a world where the earliest Upanishads would have been current, particularly the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Chandogya Upanishads. I can write these down at a later date. And so much of what the Buddha says, you can very often see that he's addressing a topic that's already current in his period. Now, I know this might sound a little bit abstract and historical and technical, but I do think it's important. I also think it's important, and we'll see why it's important as I proceed. Like, for example, the title of this course is Namarupa, right? Is that the title? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's one of the words in the title. And if it didn't get across to you, that's what I'm going to call it, Namarupa. Now, Namarupa is a term that's used in Buddhism, but actually it wasn't a word that the Buddha coined. It was a word that's already found in the Upanishads. So in other words, to understand Namarupa, which I think is a key Buddhist idea, you have to know what it meant already at the Buddha's time. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just sort of guesswork. And most Buddhists, I mean certainly, let's say the Tibetan Buddhists, have no idea that Namarupa was actually a word that was already in existence at the Buddha's time and had a very specific meaning. And the Buddha uses it in a way that's actually here's Aram. Hi Aram. I think we're now complete. The Buddha uses this word in a way that actually serves as a critique of the Brahmanic or the Hindu tradition. We will come back to that. We'll spend quite a lot of time on that. So that's a good example. The other thing I feel is important to understand is not just the world in which the Buddha lived, but also what kind of life did this person Siddhartha Gautama lead? What went on in his life? What was he just an ascetic monk who lived in the country largely, teaching monks, wandering from village to village, giving Dharma talks? Or was he more engaged in his world? What was he actually trying to do? In other words, how do we represent to ourselves today this figure, the Buddha? So when we say, the Buddha said, and you read this in a lot of English language books, it says, the Buddha says, and sometimes they don't even give a source, blah, 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 blah. The Buddha says the world is created by the mind. I read that on a big poster the other day. Now, what the hell does that mean? Who is this man, the Buddha? What's he trying to do? What's his aim in life? Not only in terms of his spiritual religious thinking, but in terms of how he is reflecting upon and critiquing the social structure, the political structure of his day. This aspect of the Buddhist teaching is largely forgotten by Buddhists. They're interested in the Dharma, they're interested in how you can attain enlightenment, as though that occurs in a kind of private zone in your own mind. Whereas in fact I think the Buddha was doing something far more complex than that, and I think far more radical. So throughout these mornings together, we're going to keep going back to the world of ancient India and trying to refer the Buddha's teaching back to ideas current in his time, and we're also going to consider the Buddha's own aims and purposes in his life. I don't want this to sound like a self-promoting spiel, but much of this you'll find in this recent book of mine by happy coincidence. And so you might actually find that, if you haven't read this book, you might find that helpful. Maybe not during this retreat, but afterwards, if you want to pursue any of these ideas, you'll find a lot of it has already been written up. But I'm going to go into a lot more detail on certain topics than you'll find in that book. So that's the background, really. What I'd like to suggest we start with... Oh, yes, one more practical thing. You have been sent by email a great big wadge of text. Now, I'm not going to expect all of you to print that out. You might find that more useful for later reference. But what I've sent last night to Aviv was just two pages of text, which I'm going to focus on in the next couple of days. You'll get that today or tomorrow. Don't worry about it. I'm not going to cover all of that today anyway, just maybe half of it if we're lucky. The reason I don't plan in advance what I'm going to do every day, that's why I can't send you nice academic looking handouts. I don't work that way. I want to respond to what comes up in your questions and see where we go, see how long we want to focus on one topic or another, perhaps go off in a digression. And that's why I've given you my whole collection of texts. This collection, by the way, is called Source Texts for Secular Buddhism, and it's a project I've been working on for the last few years, and I've just been taking passages from the Pali Canon, compiling them under topic, so there's several topics that are listed, and trying to create a kind of a proto-secular Buddhist canon. In other words, core texts that speak very much to our condition in this world. Secular, for me, doesn't mean anti-religious, although there's a whiff of that, maybe quite a strong whiff of that, if I'm to be completely honest. But really, I like to think of secular as referring to this world. The word in Latin, seculum, means this age, this time. And in other words, a secular approach is one that's concerned with this age, this time, this place, rather than concerned with what will happen after death, or concerned with what is occurring in some higher transcendent reality called God or something. I'm interested. I don't believe in rebirth. It might be the case that we get reborn. I just have no idea. I find it very difficult to understand how that could possibly be the case. And it's a sort of question that was already around at the Buddha's time. I'm going to keep that purely to one side. I'm almost certain people will ask questions about it, as happens in every course I give. So we'll look at it if you want. But frankly, I think it's a total, it's totally beside the point. What I'm concerned with, and as I will argue the Buddha was primarily concerned with, was how do we live in this world? How do I live in an authentic and in a fruitful, in a flourishing way, both in my inner life and also in my relations with others? And for me, the Buddha's teaching is of value because it provides us with a framework within which to address the concerns of our own time, both subjectively, intersubjectively, and possibly also wider than that in terms of, say, for example, our relationship to the environment in particular, our relationship to, say, political issues, economic issues. If Buddhism can't do that, then it's going to be condemned to marginality in small interest groups, but it won't actually, I think, really engage with the mainstream issues of our time. And I think, for me, that's important. Right, so let's stand up and stretch our legs. I'm going to have sitting. I don't know whether we'll have much time for walking, but rather than walking, we might just stand and stretch our legs here, if that's okay. Let's just see how it goes. Let's stand up for a few moments. Some of you may not be used to sitting cross-legged on the floor, and there don't appear to be any chairs.
There are a few.
So, the aim of the exercise is not to cause great pain in your knees. So I really try and have periods where we really do some sort of bending exercises, just sort of, you know, flex your legs so that knees, or swing them round if you have some sort of exercise you're used to doing, just to get the blood and the energy moving in the body again. Maybe swirling, turning your shoulders, because they get stiff when you meditate, bending over. I'm not a great body person, I'm afraid. I live in my head, so you're probably more adept at doing this than I am. And again, breathe more deeply. Okay, and then when you're ready, let's sit down again. And we're going to sit for about 20 minutes. I want to alternate sitting with talking, with discussing. I think the sitting is very important in terms of creating the right kind of frame of mind, frame of being, in which to reflect on what we're going to be discussing. So that we quieten our minds, we get more focus, we get more steady. Now, is there anyone here who's never sat in meditation before? So before I go on to the specific topic of this series of talks, namely the self, nama rupa, consciousness and so on, I want to look at a couple of texts that locate the Buddha's understanding in a rather wider context. And the first text I'm going to look at is a text called the Sabha Sutta, the discourse on Sabha. Sabha means all, everything, the totality. It's the common Pali Sanskrit word, all sentient beings. And the Buddha asks, and what, monks, is the all? The eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile sensations, the mind and dhammas, things. I'll explain them. This is called the all. If anyone, monks, should say, I reject this all, I shall make known another all, that would be merely an empty boast on his part. If he were questioned, he wouldn't be able to reply, and further, he would meet with vexation. Why? Because, monks, that all would not be within his domain. That's the end of the text. That is a sutta, a discourse. It occurs in an obscure part of the canon, Samyutta Nikaya 35.23, page 1140 in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. In other words, not something that is highlighted and prominent in the Buddhist canon. But and I only came across it, I only noticed it fairly recently. The problem with reading the Pali Canon, if you've ever tried, is that it has a great soporific effect. It can make you very weary and tired with all its repetitions, and or seeming repetitions. It's not reader friendly at all. And as you can see from here, page 1140, and that's only one in one of the four main sections, it's long. There's a lot of it. And it's basically almost a kind of just miscellaneous collection of material, of text, and loosely arranged around theme in this particular volume, the Samyutta Nikaya. So I must have read this at least once or twice and not actually registered that it might be interesting or important. Someone else actually pointed it out to me, a fellow scholar. I think there's an awful lot in here that serves as a very good foundation for what we're going to be exploring, because it sets the parameter of what the Buddha means by everything. Everything for the Buddha is essentially what is available to us in our experience. I think we could almost substitute, as I probably will start doing, the word experience for the all. In other words, the Buddha is concerned with experience. Now, a point I'm going to make now, and I'm going to keep repeating through the next few days, is I don't think the Buddha's interested in giving us a complete and detailed account of reality. I don't think that's his interest at all. He's interested in providing us with a model, a way of looking at the world, that will be helpful in terms of realizing his project. And his project is to fully understand dukkha, or suffering, to let go of craving, to experience the stopping of craving, and then to cultivate a path, a way of life in this world. I mean, that's my very abbreviated reading of what are otherwise called the Four Noble Truths. We'll almost certainly spend time on that text, but I don't really want to get into that until we've, as it were, explored the larger picture. If you want to summarize my approach, what the Buddha's teachings are not descriptive, they are prescriptive. They're not giving a description of, let's say, what we might call reality, in the way a scientist might. They're prescriptive in that they're giving us advice, giving us tools as to how to live. In other words, the there is a should implied in these teachings rather than an is. Although the Buddha might use the word is. For example, he says, what is the all? The eye and the forms, the ear and the sounds, the nose and the odors, the tongues and the taste, the body and the tactile sensations, the mind and the dharmas. This is called the all. Now, again, in the Buddha's time, this would have sounded rather shocking, because in the Upanishads, in the Vedas, in the Jain texts, this would not be adequate to be called everything. And maybe for some of us, we're saying there must be more to life than that. For the Buddha's time, the all would have had to include, in a very significant way, Brahman, God, some ultimate, undifferentiated, divine reality, which is not something you can see or hear or smell or taste or touch or think. It transcends what the Buddha calls everything. And then the Buddha continues, but monks, if anyone should say, I reject this, or I'll make known another all, that would be merely an empty boast on his part. And what I think he's clearly referring to is the notion that there is some higher or more absolute or truer reality beyond what merely appears to be just appearance. Buddhism, in all of its schools, has very often speaks in terms of there being two truths, the relative or the conventional truths of the world and the ultimate or the absolute truth, which is not reducible to something conventional or relative but somehow transcends them. And this is often called emptiness or Buddha nature or the true mind or the unconditioned or the deathless. Whereas here we have a text where the Buddha is clearly saying, what concerns me, what concerns those who are interested in what I'm doing, is contained within our experience of what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and experience with our minds, the dhammas, which I'll explain in a minute. Any attempt to posit something outside this, all the Buddha says, would be just an empty boast, which is, I think, a very clear critique of the tradition of his day. In fact, I'll read you a passage here, if I can find it. This is one of the few texts in the Pali Canon where the Buddha does address the issue of God. The young Brahmin Vasetta, we don't know anything about him, came to the Buddha and said, "This is the straight path. This is the direct path. The path of salvation that leads one who follows it to union with Brahma, as is taught by the Brahmin Pukarasati," presumably this guy's teacher. And the Buddha asked, but Vasetta, is there then a single one of these Brahmins, learned in the three Vedas, who has seen Brahma face to face?" And Vasetta replies, "No, Reverend Gautama." "Well, Vasetta, when these Brahmins teach a path that they do not know or see, saying this is the only straight path, this cannot possibly be right. Just as a file of blind men go on clinging to each other, and the first one sees nothing, and the middle one sees nothing, and the last one sees nothing, so it is with the talk of these Brahmins learned in the Vedas. The talk of these Brahmins turns out to be laughable, mere words, empty and vain. Vasetta, it's just as if a man were to say, 'I am in love with the most beautiful girl in the country.' And his friends might say, 'But do you know what caste she belongs to?' 'No.' 'Do you know her name, her clan, whether she's short or tall, dark or light-skinned, or where she comes from?' 'No.' And then they might say, 'Well then, you don't know or see the one you seek for and desire.' And he would say, 'No. Does not the talk of that man turn out to be stupid?'" And so on. Now this is fairly provocative stuff. And again, the Buddha's quite clearly referring to a passage within the Upanishads. And I found one, I tracked it down in the Katha Upanishad, talking about Brahman or Atman. "His form is not to be seen. No one beholds him with the eye." What else? "He cannot be reached by speech, by mind, or by the eye. How can he be apprehended?" This is God. "How can it be apprehended except by the one who says, 'He is'?" I think this possibly has resonances in the Jewish tradition too. Now the Buddha's saying, this is clearly, when he says, "Is there a single Brahmin who has seen, is there a single Brahmin who has seen Brahma face to face," in other words, has seen him, heard him, cognized him? No. The very nature of God in this tradition is that God transcends our capacity to know, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch. You have to access a quality of consciousness that is beyond our ordinary everyday consciousness. In Vedanta, this is sometimes called turiya, where you have to turn the mind inwards, away from any identification with the phenomenal world, going beyond the consciousness that is there in sleep, an unconscious deep sleep, and reaching what's called the fourth state, turiya, which is the pure consciousness of your Atman, of your deepest soul, which is identical to God. It's only in that mode of awareness that you can speak meaningfully of having any experience of God. But all language is inadequate. This is something that is beyond what you can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, know. So this is a passage, I think, that illustrates very clearly that the Buddha is critiquing. He's even making fun of, you know, the story about the girl. It's like saying you're in love with the most beautiful girl in the world. Have you seen her? Do you know her? What's her name? I don't know. Never met her, but I'm in love with her. So the Buddha's clearly addressing his people of his time, and of course, this would be just as true, I think, today. And any theistic tradition is probably going to posit some sense of God that is unknowable. the cloud of unknowing in Christian mysticism. We cannot know God. Yes? I'm going to have discussion period afterwards. I think if we could keep the questions, otherwise we're likely, knowing me, to go off on all sorts of digressions. So let me, I'm only going to speak for another 20 minutes or so, then we'll have a break, then we'll have discussion. Now, of course, I can see that you can have one could have many objections to this. I don't dispute that. And particularly those of us who are drawn to Buddhism for religious or spiritual reasons, you know, we expect there to be something that corresponds to a divine transcendent reality. The Buddha's saying, actually, you don't need that. That what is constitutes the all, everything, is actually what is going on right now. Right now. That for the Buddha, any suggestion of something lying behind appearances is just an empty boast. It's just idle chatter, idle talk. The Buddha, in that sense, is what we would call a phenomenalist. He's concerned with phenomena. Phenomena coming from the Greek phenomenon, or phenomenestai, or something, means that which appears. The Buddha's concerned with what is apparent. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't go more deeply into your experience and find things that right now may not be apparent, but whatever you arrive at, it's something that appears. It's something that is present to the senses or present to the mind. But we don't need to posit that appearance is appearance of something else. The Buddha's positing a world of pure appearance. Now, this is very close, and I've actually been quite influenced in my own thinking recently by the philosophy of Pyrrhonism. Pyrrho, you heard of Pyrrho? Mm-hmm. P-Y-R-R-H-O, Pyrrho. Mm-hmm. Pyrrho was a philosopher of the Hellenistic period, in other words, after Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. He may have studied with Aristotle. He lived at the end of Aristotle's life. What is striking, though, about Pyrrho is that he accompanied Alexander to India. He was part of Alexander's civilizing mission. Alexander sought to conquer the Persian Empire of the Achaemenids, which at that time was under the rule of Darius. And his armies, which have, you know, you've probably seen the movie with Colin Farrell, plays a rather unconvincing Alexander. It's an Oliver Stone movie. And so lots of battles and stuff. But although, of course, there was a military objective, Alexander also had the idea that he was basically introducing a civilization, Hellenic civilization. And so he took with him philosophers. Anaximander, was it Anaximander? I can't remember the exact name. And Pyrrho. And we know from the Greek historical records that the Pyrrho and Anaximander, I think it was, no, it wasn't Anaximander, Anaxarchus, whoever his name was, they spent a lot of time in dialogue with what they called gymnosophists. Gymnosophist means naked sages. Mm. Which by Greek standards probably meant anyone who wore less than a full outfit, and Buddhist monks who at that time would have worn just rags stitched together, Jain monks, sadhus, may have been naked or may have simply worn very little. They came to be known as the gymnosophists. It's where we get the word gymnasium from. Gym. I'm going to do gym today, as we said at school. Not that we ever got naked, but sort of, down to our underwear. Sophist, of course, means someone who is wise. Now, Pyrrho then came back to Greece and started a school which is subsequently and today is known as skepticism. That's the school that Pyrrho eventually founded, but I don't want to get too much into this because it gets complicated. only fragments of what Pyrrho said have come down to us. He didn't write anything. He lived very much as a kind of a hermit, as a sage. He was highly revered in his time as a wise, not only a wise person, but someone who actually embodied what he taught. And this, in fact, is characteristic of the ancient Greek philosophers, is that they didn't see philosophy as we see it today, namely as a discipline you can go and study in the university. But they saw philosophy as only having any real value if it actually healed you in some way, if it actually transformed the quality of your life. And for Pyrrho, at least as what we know from Pyrrho's disciple Timon, Pyrrho advocated two things: speechlessness or non-conceptuality, we might say, which leads to ataraxia, which means an experience in which you no longer experience trouble. That's what it literally means, ataraxia. In other words, peace, tranquility, inner calm. That was the goal of the philosophy. I don't think in most university departments today that is actually what the goal of the exercise is about. But for the ancient Greeks, whether it's Aristotle or Plato, but particularly amongst the Hellenists, Pyrrho, the Stoics, Epicurus, the aim of the practice, and it was a practice, it was a discipline, was to achieve a state of inner well-being, peace, wholeness, and so on. And they had spiritual exercises, much like the sort of meditations we do here. As far as we know, there's no record of exactly what they did. But in any case, Pyrrho's philosophy is also a philosophy of appearance. For Pyrrho, there is just what appears. He said there is, I think the word is omalon, no more than that. That any idea that somehow the appearance is the appearance of something that we can't see, that's an unjustified statement, for the very fact we can't see it. So what Pyrrho critiques, I think, is very similar here to what the Buddha critiques. And there have been, over the years, people who have argued that Pyrrho's philosophy was influenced by Buddhism, or at least Indian ideas of a similar nature. So what Pyrrho rejects is the idea that the world can somehow be divided into what is apparent and what is hidden, what is in the light, what is in the dark. If that were Kantian philosophy, it would be phenomenon and noumenon, or, as Buddhists later came to speak, conventional truth and absolute truth, or, as the Brahmins would have said, the world of Maya, the world of illusion, and behind that the world of truth or Brahman. So the Buddha and Pyrrho seem to agree that just making that distinction in the first place is problematic. And although Buddhism, all forms of Buddhism, have in fact made such a split between conventional and ultimate truth, is the famous one, the Buddha never uses those terms at all. And that might come as a surprise, because it's such a basic way of thinking in Buddhist teaching. And the idea is that awakening or enlightenment is about breaking through what's apparent to what is real. What is real is shunyata, or true mind, or something like that. Whereas what we experience here and now is just somehow illusory, somehow not really real. And the Buddha refuses to make that distinction in a very consistent way throughout the Pali Canon. There's no ultimate truth, no absolute truth. In other words, he's kind of saying, stop thinking in that way. Stop starting on the premise of a split-level reality. Just attend more totally to what is occurring now. And as you're probably aware, if you've looked into the practice of mindfulness, it's all about paying attention to the crow, the garbage truck. Things that are not necessarily terribly exotic, actually things extremely mundane. And let me just read you to remind you of the Buddha's description of account of mindfulness. You may be starting to get the reason why you have all these texts and why virtually everything I say will be in this handout. But I'm not going to be presenting it in a systematic way. As you can see, I'm sort of wandering all over the place. It's my style. Okay, so here we have a very famous passage. It's from the Satipatthana Sutta. Again, monks, a monk is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and coming back, when looking ahead, when looking away, when flexing and extending his limbs, when wearing his robes and carrying his bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. Again, everything that's mentioned here is within the domain of our immediate experience here and now. The Buddha speaks of mindfulness as starting with awareness of the breath, awareness of the body, awareness of our feelings, awareness of our mental states, and then awareness of Dhamma, this term that I've yet to explain. It basically means all things, everything. The Buddha's not interested, and again, in the context of his time, this is, I think, important, he's not interested in turning the mind inwards to try to uncover or reach some deeper, truer reality that lies behind what is apparent. In fact, he does the very opposite. And this, again, these sort of teachings must have been very shocking for many of his listeners. What do you mean you don't seek to achieve union with the divine through introspection and yogic tapas? Instead, he's saying, no, don't disentangle yourself from the senses, but learn to be more fully present within your sensory experience. The experience is enriched or in a sense deepened, not by moving away from what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, but by going more deeply into it, becoming more totally present to what is happening. So it's back to front in terms of what would have been the case at his time. He's asking us to turn our attention to the world of experience, to ordinary things, and to pay attention to them in a very different way. A way which is grounded in a kind of inner stillness, which we call shamatha, and at the same time attending to these phenomena as being impermanent, as being dukkha, as being anatta, not self. In later Buddhist thought, they would use the word empty, which doesn't mean they don't exist, but it means that they don't exist in some sort of inherent way. In other words, there is no sort of core essential reality behind them. That things are what they are because they emerge out of the causes, conditions, circumstances that gave rise to them. This stuff doesn't deny that each person is utterly unique and distinct, or each thing is utterly unique and distinct. But their distinctiveness, their difference, their uniqueness is not because they somehow embody some essential reality that's different from all other essential realities, my true self. They are different because they emerge out of a different complex of circumstances and conditions. That's how difference occurs. In other words, you are different from me, not because you are your soul or your essence is different from my essence, but because the circumstances that have given rise to your life are necessarily different from the circumstances that gave rise to mine. So when you say not self, you're not denying that each person is an utterly unique and distinct self. what's being challenged is the idea that that difference resides in something essential as opposed to something contingent, namely the circumstances of our particular existence. And likewise, as we'll see, the Buddha is concerned about how do I evolve and individuate as a self and a person. And I do that by making choices, by making decisions, by acting, by behaving in a certain way. That is what comes to define me as a more and more differentiated person. And we'll come back to that. There's many texts that support that reading. But if we go back to this idea of the all, another passage that is often quoted, which I think makes the same point, we find this passage twice in the canon, once in reference to a man called Bahya, and once in reference to a monk called Malunkyaputta. And the Malunkyaputta is a man who comes to the Buddha and asks him if he can present his teaching in brief. Can you show me the Dharma in brief? Malunkyaputta is an old man. He wants something simple and straightforward, not this complicated stuff that I've been saying, so that I might dwell alone, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And the Buddha says, here, Malunkyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you, in the seen, there is merely the seen. In the heard, there is merely the heard. In the sensed, there is merely the sensed, and in the cognized, merely the cognized. In other words, there's just that. Don't add on to that any other theory about it being, the appearance of something else, or having some essential nature, or running some other kind of story or commentary. Just learn to see what is seen, to hear what is heard, to smell what is smelt, to taste what is tasted, to touch what is touched. In fact, this passage, as a friend of mine recently pointed out, is actually in the imperative voice. In other words, in the seen, just see, is actually a more accurate translation. In the heard, just hear. In the smelt, just smell.
This is like Bahia.
It is Bahia. It's the same passage, same text. Yeah, it's exactly the same text as Bahia, word for word. But it regards, this is concerning Malunkyaputta. Now this too, you see, I think fits very, very well with this view of the world, that all we need be concerned about to realize what the Buddha's trying to teach us is the world of appearance. Again, I have to repeat this. The Buddha is not trying to give us a definitive and final description of reality. He's presenting us a model wherein which the goals of his practice can be realized. In other words, it's a pragmatic model. It's not an ontological model. It's very difficult to get out of this habit of mind. We're all ontologists, even though we don't know, half of us may not know what the word means. Ontology means the thinking about being. In other words, we are all inheritors of the Aristotelian idea that something either is or it is not. And there's no middle. It's the law of the excluded middle. Something either is or something is not. The Buddha denies this. Pyrrho denies this. I'll bring a text of Pyrrho to show you. This is seen to be an utterly inadequate way of describing experience. The Buddha seems to be pointing, in fact, to, instead of an excluded middle, he's talking of an excluded middle way. His middle way, we'll come back to this, is a middle way between being and non-being. He says this very explicitly, and may as well cite the passage. Find it. This world, Kachana, the Buddha speaking again, for the most part depends upon a duality, a double, upon the notion of existence and on the notion of non-existence. The words in Pali are ati and nati, on the notion of it is and the notion of it is not. But for one who sees the origin or the arising of the world with true intelligence, there's no notion of non-existence with regard to the world. And for one who sees the ceasing of the world, the disappearance of things, with right intelligence, there's no notion of it is in regard to the world. Everything exists, Kachana, that's one dead end. Nothing exists, Kachana, that's the other dead end. Without veering towards either dead end, the Tathagata, the Buddha, teaches the Dharma by the middle. So, in other words, another way in which the Buddha's teaching is not to get caught up in this idea of this exists and this doesn't exist. He's not actually interested in ontology, of trying to define what it means to be. Once again, he's trying to introduce a way of life, a way of life in this world, in this experience. We don't need to believe that there is something more essential than what is actually apparent to us. There's a famous statement of Timon, the disciple of Pyrrho, who says that honey is sweet, I do not dispute, but that it has the nature of sweetness, I make no comment. Yes, honey is sweet, but is that its nature to be sweet? Well, we don't know. We don't need to posit essences, we simply need to acknowledge how our experience presents appearance, a phenomena to us. So, that's the... I'm going to stop there, and it's 11:15, we're going to have a break. And then we'll come back and we'll open this up for discussion. And then there's another text I'd like to look at. I'd also like to have time for more sitting. But let's now break for, say, 15 minutes. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes will do. Okay, enjoy. I'll ring the bell a couple of minutes before the time, okay?
Are you recording it?
Yes. Okay.